morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the local news hour on KPCW. Well, the Summit County Council met yesterday at the County Courthouse in Colville. On the phone to review some of the items discussed, I have County Council Member Doug Clegg. Good morning, Doug.
Good morning, Leslie.
First, the council reviewed the fairgrounds update, first phase. The plan is to tear down the Quonset Hut, which has been around since the 1950s. The new building will be bigger with more amenities. So what's it going to look like?
Hard to describe on the radio, but it is the replacement of the facilities in the Quonset Hut, and then perhaps a much larger structure is the replacement of the barn facilities that house animals during the fair.
Okay, so when we talk about the Quonset Hut replacement, we're just going to have like a modern new brick, or not brick, just basically rectangle building?
No, it has some architectural interest to it. You know, as usual, trying to balance cost with providing good aesthetics. But we've hired an architect who is providing us with an interesting, we believe, interesting and hopefully somewhat timeless bit of architecture that will stand the test of time.
I think you heard that the project already $360,000 over budget and a week or so behind schedule. So how are we going to adjust for that?
We've simply informed them that that's not acceptable, and they're simply going to have to value engineer that out of the cost. And if that means ultimately less facilities, then that's what it's going to mean. Hopefully they'll be able to design their way through it. And it's a $5 million project, so $360,000 at a very preliminary state of budgeting is not in and of itself an insurmountable problem.
And I think you pointed out, Doug, that the budget doesn't have money to adjust if winter conditions should hit. So if that happens, what do we do?
We just simply have to make sure that the project moves forward and timely. We're not expecting any major interruptions, but if we have them, you know, we have a permit approval in Colville. This is in the city of Colville, so we have to go through a permit approval with Colville. We're expecting that to happen timely. We've told them that schedule is the most important thing because we have to avoid winter conditions. And if we have bumps in the road and the project slows down, then we'll just have to deal with it when we get there.
So do you think locals are going to miss the old Quonset Hut, or have we had enough of it?
Apparently there is some strong attachment to the Quonset Hut. I suggested that perhaps it might be an historic building, and I think there were some stones thrown at me at the time. But, you know, it's a unique structure.
Okay.
A long history.
But it's going. So go to the fair and enjoy the last time that you can visit the Quonset Hut.
That's right.
All right. Let's see. Turning to renewable energy, does the county council feel they can get to net 100% renewable by 2022 for county operations, as well as putting the entire county on net renewable energy by 2032?
Not net 100% by 22, but perhaps 32. That is the goal that we discussed. The staff will bring us back a resolution that has that goal in it. Process is that we would pass that resolution and then we would enter into an MOU with Rocky Mountain Power to, along with Park City and with Salt Lake, in an attempt to meet that schedule.
Why are we doing this?
I think for a number of reasons. First of all, we're strongly on record as being in support of the problem of climate change and remediating that problem. And much like Park City and Salt Lake City, we have determined that we have a hand in the problem and we can be part of the solution. And we've heard a lot from citizens that they want us to be proactive in this issue.
So if we do go for some kind of renewable portfolio, you say you are working with Rocky Mountain Power, but if not them, then who?
Well, that's the whole issue. I mean, Rocky Mountain Power obviously is the player here. We have a, you know, we have a monopoly in power in the state. They are under a lot of pressure to clean up their power, and we're just hoping to contribute to that effort.
So you saw charts showing that for the next decade or so, Rocky Mountain Power will derive the bulk of its electrical energy from coal. In time, we'll possibly draw more from natural gas. So I guess I just, you know, it's like we may be trying to use more electric vehicles, but if the bottom line is that we're just using coal to generate these electric vehicles, have we moved the needle at all?
Well, that's the point. The point of this whole process is to get on a program that will make measurable change. And, you know, sure, we're buying electric vehicles. Sure, we've got electric buses. We're working on all these things. But I think the point that staff made is that we're not going to move the needle until we get involved in a process that has firm goals and achievable and definable objectives to change the source of power to the county, to the city, to Salt Lake, from coal and to and natural gas to renewables. The bright spot here in this whole conversation is that going forward in the future, and this will be an ever-improving situation, renewables are the cheapest source of generating electricity now. So if we, you know, this is a wheel that if we give it a small push, it'll roll by itself. Because obviously, if the economics are that the least expensive way to generate electricity is by renewables, we just have to give it a nudge.
It looks like you have several options to look at. There's this concept called CRET, Community Renewable Energy Tariff. There's also this community choice aggregation where a locality buys or generates energy for its own residents. Are we moving forward with both of those, with one of those, or still considering it?
Well, that's an immensely complicated discussion, but essentially the problem with the community contribution policy is that it is there are legislative bars in place to prevent that from happening, and that's why we currently are looking at CREP. Now, we think that entire thing could change over the next few years as the legislature becomes more or as legislative issues become more fluid. But right now, both Salt Lake and Park City are proceeding on the CREP process.
All right. Now, do we try and pursue to get some kind of solar energy or wind farm installation located here?
It's going to take a lot of study. It's a balance between what are the economic advantages of doing it locally versus what are the efficiencies of doing it at a more remote but perhaps more efficient site. And we just we don't have data right now to answer that question. But both scenarios are likely to be part of the solution.
I mean, is that practical? I mean, would we really get a usable amount of energy, or is that just good PR?
Well, that's exactly our concern. We're not interested in building facilities here if all that is eyewash. But at the same time, when you build facilities locally, you provide revenue, taxes, jobs, et cetera. So it's a balancing act. Local facilities may not be as efficient, but they provide revenue, they provide taxes, and they provide, in some cases, transmission efficiencies. One of the problems is that we're fighting the grid. you have to push power around the country from one source to another, and so sometimes you cannot get power from the source that you want because the grid is not capable of supplying it.
All right. Again, this is coming back via resolution for the county council, so there'll be more discussion about it.
That's correct, yeah. First a resolution and then perhaps an MOU with Rocky Mountain Power to follow up.
All right. During comments, council talked briefly about whether the county should do more with regard to senior living facilities. You've got one of those in your neighborhood in Oakley, Doug. How is that one working?
Well, I drive by it every day. As far as I know, it's considered to be a community benefit. Of course, for the city of Oakley, I think it generates some revenue. It's an attractive looking facility. I think it's a great part of the neighborhood.
So, as we both get older, I mean, is it something that we do need more of, and what is the county's role in making that happen?
Well, the county's role is essentially the zoning administrator more than anything else. We do allow for those facilities in our code. And to some extent, we may get proactively involved in it, but that's a discussion that we just haven't had yet.
All right. And then finally, during public input, you heard from a group of Old Ranch Road residents with two basic complaints. One, that there are some small lots that are putting in a lot of accessory buildings, and two, some owners bringing in a lot of farm animals. The folks you heard from, people, longtime residents like Debbie Scoggin, Skip and Kathy Slusher, Richard and Jill Scheinberg. I know you just got introduced to it, but what's your take?
Well, again, this is a land use regulation issue. To segregate the discussion, the building issue is a property rights issue. If you own a piece of property and you have room to put a storage shed on it, or you have room to put a barn on it, the question is, should that be allowed? And the way the code is currently written, the answer is yes, it is allowed. And it is allowed without limitations. And that is a very, very complex question. If somebody builds a horse riding arena on their property, that could be a 30,000 square foot structure. Now, do we want to get involved in the business of telling them that they can't build a horse riding arena on their property? Relative to that, what we've asked is for staff to essentially outline the discussion, outline the issues for us, and bring it back to council so that we can talk about it further. The ag issue is, we live in a state that is very favorable to ag, and our zoning regulations reflect the state regulations. Is there an argument to be made that you should only be allowed to have so many animal units per acre? Yeah, absolutely. But how do we approach that? It's very complicated. These are ag facilities. They produce anything from fruits and vegetables to animals for slaughter, The question is to what degree and how much should we be regulating that?
So back to the building issues, are these buildings for housing people, animals, or storage?
The code is pretty specific about what you can do for residents. In that particular zone, you're allowed essentially one mother-in-law apartment or accessory dwelling unit. There are two classifications for that. One is just for your own private purposes. The other is for an agricultural employee. And there's some distinctions between the two. But irrespective, you're only allowed one. Relative to buildings, relative to outbuildings of sort of unspecified uses, for storage or for hay or for farm animals or what have you,
KPCW News Time, 8:31. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the local news hour on KPCW. Well, the applicants for Treasure Hill back before the Park City Planning Commission last night. Not much changing. Both the Planning Commission and the public commenting once again that they're still waiting for specifics on how the applicants' plans to mitigate the development's impacts are coming along. Treasure Hill applicant Pat Sweeney did present a new design just a few hours before yesterday's meeting was to begin. He told commissioners that, simply put, the goal of all of the refinements is to build efficiency, to reduce excavation, and to reduce the impacts of cliffscapes. Those are the areas where they would need to burrow down and back into the hillside. After seeing the presentation of the new plans, planning commissioners went on with the agenda after being assured that they would be provided with those same slides that the applicant had presented. Joining me now in the studio with a kind of a recap of the meeting, I have the chairman of the Planning Commission, Adam Strong. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So you heard from Treasure Hill traffic engineer Gary Horton defending his credibility, which had come into question by members of Think, I believe. Was that necessary? Was the commission questioning the results of this study?
I don't know that it was necessary. I mean, he was defending more his integrity. What we're more interested in are his actual numbers, where the numbers came from, what's the basis for the study, whether it's based in fact or not, whether he feels his integrity is under attack by the commission or not, really isn't relevant to whether the CUP criteria are being met and or mitigated. So I didn't think it moved the needle much, but if Gary needed to do it, he can use the applicant's time for that purpose.
All right. Well, you heard from senior planner Francisco Astorga basically saying traffic forecasting, like weather forecasting, it's very scientific but not exact. So is that something that the Planning Commission should take into account, or do you want more accuracy in predictions?
Well, we want as much accuracy as we can reasonably get. You know, there is no way, for instance, to say that a traffic count taken on one day is going to perfectly transpose and be an identical situation on a different day under different conditions. I mean, we have to make some assumptions and some logical leaps. So we want to be as accurate as we can, but we're never going to know 100% of all facts. So the way we've tried to do that is to get studies not just from the applicant, but from the transportation folks, Alfred Knotts, and also from the Think group, so we can look at all of the different sides and what their numbers are and how they see the situation.
So a lot of time was spent talking to staff, questions about the packet, the confusing information and wording. Commissioner Steve Joyce in particular spent a lot of time going through it, saying it was because of the applicant's goal of pulling the trigger and asking for a decision. So do you think the Planning Commission will be able to pull all of this together before the applicant does make that request?
Well, the timeline is I think, a little bit different than what you're saying. So the applicant, as far as we understand it, is going to pull the ripcord in the next meeting in September, which I think is September 13th. From that point, under Utah state law, we have 45 days to render a decision. With a record this large, spanning several months and 14 meetings, Commissioner Joyce's question and the question I think of every commissioner and probably all the public is, can we get everything together in time in 45 days? And, you know, staff is going to work diligently. We may do some supplemental meetings, but under a deadline like that, we don't have a choice. So one way or another, we'll get it done.
Yeah. So I guess it was talked about adding some meetings. I mean, how many are we talking about?
I don't know. You know, I think what's going to have to happen is once the applicant pulls a ripcord, we say, all right, applicant, all your evidence is in. You've told us everything about your project. Although some questions may still be unanswered in our minds, to you, applicant, this is your last day. You cannot submit anything further, no further information. And then at that point, the staff and the Planning Commission will probably engage in a work session to figure out exactly what the scope of all the information is and how we're going to cull it down and get it into some sort of findings of fact and conditions of approval or some sort of decision document.
So have you gotten through all of the 14 different areas that you were looking at originally?
We have. The bigger ones like traffic and excavation appropriately took more time than some of the other ones like, for instance, open space. I mean, open space has never really been a debatable issue. So I think we've gotten through them. I don't think there has been resolution on a lot of those. I don't think all the commissioners know exactly where they stand, but the applicant seems to have presented most, if not all, of the information on those issues that they're willing to present.
The applicant talked about cliffscapes again, maybe even reducing those. But you did hear from Arnie Rustin, a civil engineer, showing a few pictures about what the applicant was actually proposing. How much of an impact did his comments and photos have on the Planning Commission?
Well, you know, photos are always helpful. Without hard numbers, it's a little bit difficult. Showing some photos on you know, the televisions in the room is what needs to really happen is show the photo with the measurement of exactly how high the cliffscape is and then compare that to what the Treasure Hill applicants are putting forth. Just saying, here's a cliffscape, Treasure's going to do the same thing. We have to rely on Arnie. We don't have any measurements, actual measurements, and it's data, not opinion, that we're looking for.
Yeah, he had also said that construction was the elephant in the room, and he wanted to point out that excavation alone would take 2.5 years, maybe even longer. We're talking about some 300 trucks traveling down Lowell every day. Basically, he figured out a truck every 2 minutes in a 10-hour day. So, again, that's something that has to be mitigated.
It does have to be mitigated, and, you know, those estimates are, I think, you know, up in the air right now, but there is certainly going to be a large number of trucks that are going up and down those roads, and that impact is going to have to be mitigated. I mean, I think Commissioner Joyce succinctly raised a very good point, which was we have not heard from the applicant or anyone what happens when one truck is going down Lowell and one truck is coming up Lowell, because we all know at times that's a one-way street or a one-lane street. And, you know, it's those simple questions that I think we're sort of raising our hands and going, you know, what is the answer to that? What is the applicant's answer, and does that mitigate the impact? And we still don't know.
He also heard from Kyra Parkhurst, who says she's been going to the meetings for the last 8 years and hasn't heard a single comment about how a person is supposed to, a pedestrian is supposed to travel on Lowell safety. Where are the sidewalks? Was she exaggerating with this?
I think Ms. Parkhurst's comment was right along the lines of Commissioner Joyce's, is, you know, we have not heard from the applicant what a pedestrian is supposed to do. For instance, a pedestrian who is walking from PCMR up to, say, a home on Lowell or Empire. What route do they take? And at what times should they avoid it during construction? You know, there's just been no explanation at all about that.
And finally, just wanted to note, land use attorney Jody Burnett was hired by Park City to sit through these Treasure meetings. So he's been at all of these, huh?
He's been in all of them, and his role is going to become greater and greater here as we get down to the final hours. He is most likely going to be in charge of working with staff to draft that final decision document. He is incredibly experienced, and this is not his first rodeo. So he has been sitting there taking notes and I'm sure has been collecting all of the applicants' submittals in his databases and going through them, and probably already has a running start on getting some type of decision document together. But Jody is now going to be pulling the laboring or more and more.
Yeah. So, I mean, basically at a cost of $300 an hour, I don't know what the going rate is, but this is a cost that city taxpayers are absorbing, correct? Or is this something that gets paid for with the application fees?
No, city taxpayers pay for, at least it's my understanding. I mean, I could be wrong about that, but I believe that when the city hires outside counsel, the city's coffers pay for that.
Real quick on the issue of flat roofs, pitched roofs. Things got a little heated between Commissioners Joyce and Phillips about what the point of discussion was. Phillips has a house with a flat rooftop, and he's saying it would not be approved under the proposed amendments. Steve Joyce saying that the commission wasn't asked to determine what was beautiful or appealing, just what would better protect the historic nature of the town. So are we talking apples and oranges, or is Steve Joyce right here?
Well, there is no right or wrong answer on these things, and I think that is kind of what the Planning Commission and the Historic Preservation Board, which spent apparently four meetings going back and forth on flat roofs, was debating. We came down yesterday and decided that, you know, we just needed more time to figure that out. But I don't think any of the commissioners are ready to say, you know, Commissioner Joyce is right and we're going to vote accordingly, or Commissioner Phillips is right, we're going to vote accordingly. It's a tough issue. I mean, in the 10 years that I've been on the Planning Commission, I've seen flat roofs probably twice before. This is the third time. I know the HPV struggled with it. It's just one of those issues that everybody has a different answer on.
Okay. What do you need more information, or you just need more time to think about it?
I think some of the commissioners, you know, I don't personally need a lot more information. I think a lot of the commissioners do. They want to go around and look at some of the flat roof homes and, you know, discuss some of the language changes to the land management code that are being proposed. But, you know, I mean, I've looked at this before, and I think the code changes proposed make sense. And I typically defer to staff, you know, Anya Gron and Hannah Tyler are very experienced and very good at this. And if they recommend things like this, I'm usually willing to take their recommendations.
Okay. Adam Strong, thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks, Leslie.
Well, last month we reported on Vail Resort's commitment to a net zero operating footprint by 2030. On the phone to explain. Oh, it looks like he came back through again. So Rob Whittier is Vail Resort's company's sustainability director. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
The company, as I mentioned, announced its epic promise for a zero footprint, committing the company to zero net emissions, zero waste to landfill by 2030, and then zero net operating impacts on forests and habitat. So where did this come from?
You know, Vail Resorts has been focused on the environment and sustainability for some time. We launched our first focused energy initiative actually all the way back in 2008. And I would say it's been the success of our programs around energy and around waste reduction and the momentum that's sort of built internally that's put us in a place where we were really looking for what the next step would be. And when we looked across the industry and across our peers and even at you know some of the leading firms around the world, the idea of zero footprint really made sense for us. And so it's been something a long time in the making.
So basically, the companies realize that it's in the snow business, and unless things change, the predictions of climate change, especially affecting mountain resorts, are coming true, huh?
You know, I would actually say that the company's position is that we think that climate change is a significant issue globally, but it's an issue for, you know, a number of reasons. And the effect actually on the outdoor industry specifically is sort of the least of our concerns. If climate change predictions are true, right, we're going to have a lot bigger things to worry about than melting snow.
Let's talk about how much money is the company willing to throw at this?
Sure. So obviously there's some investment that will be required on the part of the company. You know, our commitment specifically to renewable energy will require us to look at some mid- to long-term investments in renewable energy projects. And our commitment to energy efficiency, you know, as part of our commitment to an additional 15% reduction, we are committed to capital from $20 to $25 million over the span of the program to focus on energy efficiency. But when you say what money are we willing to throw at this, we consider all of those really good investments and smart business. Our investments in energy efficiency projects at our resorts, we anticipate to have, you know, immediate and impactful returns, both economically and improvements to our operating. And our investment in renewable energy, right, we're also looking to make smart, sound investments there too. And the economics of of solar and wind and other technologies have come so far that we think we can make good business decisions that are also good environmental decisions.
And I'm guessing some of that money would be spent on new staff to make this happen. I mean, are we talking about adding to the sustainability department? How many do you have now, and how many do you think you need?
That's a great question. So we actually have a sustainability or environmental manager at most of our major resorts, and we have some energy staff that works with me back here in Broomfield. You know, we think that one of the opportunities we have is to use our existing staff, you know, more effectively to reach some of these goals. Our employees are incredibly passionate about sustainability, as well as our communities, right? And we think that by providing them with the right tools and programs and training to help them implement these programs, that we can achieve a lot of this with our existing team. It's really about unlocking their passion and potential, as well as engaging our guests in that process as well.
So all of the resorts are part of this, including the recent additions of Stowe, Whistler Blackcomb, and such?
Absolutely. And, you know, with Stowe and Whistler Blackcomb, we acquired two resorts that are already doing amazing things in terms of the environment and sustainability. Whistler Blackcomb, you know, really has been one of the leaders in the mountain resort industry. And, in fact, you know, looking at their commitment and some of the things that they've already done helped us shape and progress our own sort of template for what we thought we could do globally.
Yeah, so it's probably not, though, one-size-fits-all for the resorts. Are everyone going to be doing a little bit something differently?
Nope, great question. So, yeah, the opportunity is slightly different everywhere. I mean, some of our resorts are further along than others. Some of our resorts have bigger opportunities in terms of the energy side, for example. And some of our resorts, you know, the composition of our resorts is different. Some of our resorts have a heavy hospitality element. Some of them don't. So how and where we use energy and create waste at each of our resorts is different. So we're going to create a resort-level roadmap for each one of them to help them achieve sort of the corporate goals.
So zero net emissions. Just for clarification purposes, Rob, we often hear the term as net zero. Are we talking about the same thing, or does zero net mean something else?
Nope, it means the same thing. I mean, obviously, our resort, some of the equipment at our resort will, does burn fuel and does use energy, and there are emissions related to that. What our commitment is to where we do use energy to reduce energy use as much as possible, and then to find ways to use the cleanest energy possible. And in areas where we still have to burn fuel that does have an output, we'll find a way to invest in carbon offset projects or other projects that reduce emissions so that we can net out our emissions.
So when Vail talks about its, you know, total carbon load, I mean, is it willing to accept the number of airplane emissions as people travel to get to and from your resorts, or does that not count as part of your carbon load that you need to offset?
Sure. We look at the emissions from sort of across our operations specifically, and so that's everything that happens on our resorts, on our hospitality properties. We do operate, you know, for example, in Colorado, the Colorado Mountain Express, and so those are emissions from our operations. There are certainly tertiary emissions that happen. The technical term right is scope 3 emissions. From guest travel, from guest stay, and you know we've looked at those emissions. We would love to help our guests find opportunities to reduce those. A number of the airlines that our guests travel on, for example, do offer voluntary carbon offset programs. United is one that comes to mind. They've got a great program. Any flight you take, you input where you're traveling from, where you're traveling to, the number of tickets, and they give you an option to at a very small additional fee to reduce or eliminate the carbon footprint from your travel. So what we'll look to do is find ways to help our guests engage with programs like that so they can make decisions on how to, reduce their own footprint.
Yeah. And then how far is Vail willing to go to make it happen? I mean, will you be closing off parking lots and insisting that skiers take electric vehicles or transit to your resorts?
Well, you know, we want to provide our guests with the opportunities that we can to help them make those choices. We've added electric vehicle charging stations at all of our major resorts. right? And we'll continue to look for opportunities to enhance public transportation, increase opportunities for electric vehicle transit, and you know, whatever tools we can help to provide guests with opportunities. Ultimately, we also need guests to take ownership of their footprint and make the right decisions for the environment as well. But yeah, we'll absolutely look for opportunities to engage with them and provide them with you know, with guidance and opportunities to do that.
And does Vail have the purchasing power on when we start talking about reducing its landfill waste? Does it have the purchasing power to require food suppliers to adjust their packaging and shipping processes?
Sure, yeah. We're absolutely looking at the supply chain. We do. We're obviously large. We do have, I would say, some significant purchasing power. We've also got suppliers that are, you know, eager to partner with us on this. I think since even before commitment and since our commitment, there's been an outpouring of interest in working with us to help us realize those goals. So yes, we're absolutely engaging our supply chain. You know, you mentioned food. That's obviously one big area, but there's a number of areas as well. A number of our vendors, you know, specific to the mountain resort industry, have been looking at ways to make more efficient products for snowmaking and grooming. And we're already trying some of those, and I think a commitment like this puts us in a position to advance, you know, advance those conversations even further.
And finally, just wanted, when it comes to the habitat and forest land mitigation, does this mean that you're done expanding and developing more terrain, more hotels, more retail?
No, we're not. We're not done, you know, growing. We have opportunities, you know, to improve our guest experience at our resorts. In some cases, we may remove trees for safety purposes, right? It really depends on the year and by the resort. What it means, though, is that we recognize that there is an impact to that activity, and we want to basically neutralize that impact. So where we remove an acre of forest for, you know, to widen a run for safety purposes, we will look to replant or rehabilitate another acre of forest. So, again, the concept of sort of like a net zero operating impact going forward. You know, and this is a new commitment in the mountain resort industry. We haven't seen something quite like this before. We're working with U.S. Forest Service and other partners on the best way to realize it in projects that make the most sense for them.
Okay. I need to leave it there. Rob, we look forward to hearing more about this new way of doing business. Appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Rob Whittier is the Sustainability Director for Vail Resorts. You're listening to the Local News Hour. 8:55 now. Good morning. Joining me now in the studio with our youth sports report, I have Heather Sims. She's the YSA Youth Sports Programs Director, along with Amy Jenkins, is the Vice Principal of Treasure Mountain Junior High School. Good morning, ladies.
Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So let's talk first with you, Amy, in terms of Activate is coming to Treasure Mountain Junior High School. This is kind of the next step in Let's Get Out and Play. How are we managing that there?
We are excited to add that to our after-school offerings on Mondays, on our early release day. That's the one place where we couldn't fill with our teachers supervising activities. So when Heather approached us and said she'd like to roll it up to Treasure next year, we were all on board. So our kids will be able to participate in activities now 4, possibly 5 days a week.
Wonderful. So what kind of activities are we talking about?
Well, we have some new activities specifically for that age group. We've got Park City Rowing, so we're going to be taking the kids down to Jordanelle. Biathlon, pottery, and the Egyptian Theater are also part of the new program. So we've specifically tried to make programs for that age group and hope that kids think that they're cool enough to sign up for.
And again, you'll put the word out to parents.
Yep.
There is a fee to it.
You'll yeah, there are fees. We're trying to make them as affordable as possible. And of course, as always, we offer scholarships. And so for those kids that really want to take part and can't financially bring the money to the table, we offer scholarships.
Yeah. So you've got 8th graders coming in who are familiar with the program.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so what we did in the spring last year with our Treasure students, our current 8th and 9th graders, is we surveyed them, we pulled them in as focus groups and asked them what kind of activities would you want to see. And then Heather obviously has the knowledge from the rising 8th graders from Ecker coming to us this year with what they participated in. So we're hoping between that group and meeting with the students last year that we've got the word out, we've got some ideas and interests that they've already identified. So we're hoping that it's a good fit.
Okay, so this kind of just runs through till Christmas time?
No, it's going to go all year. So it starts in September, and it's going to go all the way through to May. So on their early release day, there will always be something for them to do.
Great. And then let's talk quickly about some upcoming events with regard to Youth Sports Alliance. You've got the Circle of Excellence. This is where you honor some of your participants.
Yes, that's right. It's on August 27th at New Park. It's 4 to 6. And we have some music. And, of course, we honor the top 5% of our athletes of the teams that we support. We also honor Get Out and Play kids that have shown core values and our new Activate, some of the kids that managed to do that. And then Jan's Winter Welcome is on October 28th. Tickets are available. And we also have an opportunity drawing to go to Barcelona, Spain, and see Real Madrid play. So if any soccer players are out there interested, tickets are also on our website at ysaparkcity.org.
Okay. Again, if people would like more information about the Activate program, Amy, it's
we'll have information posted in the school during registration and back to school nights, parent-teacher conferences, and then Heather's website is where you can register.
Okay. Again,
YSAParkCity.org.
Okay. Hey, Heather and Amy, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.